Turn to the fourth case, Hutt v. Solway Pharmaceuticals. Mr. Foley?
Yes, sir.
You may proceed.
May it please the Court, I'm Donald Foley. I represent the appellant, Julia Hutt. We are here in regard to the District Court's erroneous decision of a summary judgment in favor of Solway and Abbott, denying Mrs. Hutt's right to a jury trial on her wage claim, age claim, and for the her retaliation claim. I will first move to the wage statute. The Court erred in finding that it was a requirement that Mrs. Hutt prove discrimination in order to recover on this statute. That is not a necessary burden of proof. Solway's records reflect that Mrs. Hutt excelled in her skills as a sales representative. Judge Van Brooklyn concluded that Julie Hutt's placement on a PIP and the extension of that to formal and final warnings were adverse job actions. Cases generally say you need a adverse job action. There are numerous ones in this case. The district court also found that Westfall and Lozen, Westfall was the regional sales manager, Lozen was the district sales manager, their explanations of their actions were fishy and suspicious. Leaving this court, the judge said, to wonder why they placed her on the informal warning without providing her training. The district court also found that Mr. Lozen failed to explain the expense reports, delayed
Mr.
providing
Foley,
her...
The informal warning, sorry for interrupting you, but the informal warning would not have precluded her receiving the bonuses, would it?
It would not, but they were in tandem, Your Honor. The informal warning happened on March 26th. And less than a month later, she was on a formal warning. The informal warning was made because of alleged administrative issues, which are really not her primary job responsibilities. And the same day that Lozen and Westfall provided her access to a trainer, they put her on a warning. She had no time, according to the district judge, to comply with that. I think the evidence supports that these are fishy reasons. Mrs. Hutt was put on the if Mrs. Hutt was put on the PIP for any reason that lacked merit, she is entitled to receive her pay. This case began in the Allen Superior Court, and it was filed as a wage claim statute without reference to discrimination. The burden that the district court put on Mrs. Hutt is not there under Indiana law. District court said that Lozen and Westfall may have put Julie Hutt on this PIP because they didn't like her, and not necessarily because of discrimination. If we look at the record of this case, it's pretty clear that they didn't like her. If that happened, then the decision to place Mrs. Hutt on the PIP lacks merit, and she should be entitled to pursue her wage claim and be the recipient of a jury trial. On the age discrimination issue, I want to direct the court to the targeting of Hutt and King. Hutt is 54 years old at the time. King is 59. They're the two oldest sales representatives in the Indianapolis district. They were placed on warnings and denied incentive pay bonuses and incentive pay, which is commissions and bonuses, Hutt for 7 consecutive quarters and King for 4. In January of 2008, the new district sales rep, who was an interim manager, prepared a list of names, years, and birthdays. Shortly after that, King and Hutt are targeted. They're put on formal warnings within a month of each other, negatively evaluated on the same days by the same supervisors, each singled out from sales meetings to receive those reviews. Hutt and King were the only sales representatives to receive warning status of all the Indianapolis district sales personnel. On October 20th, 2008, King and Hutt were put on final warnings the same day, the same supervisors, with similar evaluations. Portions of King's evaluation were cut and pasted onto Hutt's. She was identified as a senior sales rep. That is the title of Mr. King on those cut and paste. King was a professional sales rep, or Hutt was a professional sales representative at the time. Moving on, shortly after this, within a couple of weeks, Jeff Westfall, the regional manager, directed Mary Lawson, a district sales manager from Michigan, to meet with Hutt and to encourage her to resign or retire. The testimony reveals that Lawson told Hutt.
Counsel, I think you need to address the reason the district court decided this case against your client. The employer produced a reason, and after the employer gives a reason for its action, the plaintiff's obligation is to show that the reason is a pretext. And that's
right.
Why you lost. You really need to address in oral argument why the district court decided this case.
Well, I, Your Honor, I agree with that's what I need to do this morning, and I will do it.
Your time is quite short. You need
I know.
To do it now.
I know. There was this Mary Lawson did not get the job done. There was an amendment to their evaluations, and in fact, the evaluation was so poorly done that HR directed these supervisors to change it. And the thing that's important is that both King and Hutt does not meet in every category except sales results. That's what these guys and gal did. The survey says that this is an administrative error, which is a pretext. The Hutt and King were the only people in the whole region to be on this administrative error. No other sales representatives in the sales district or region had their evaluation for 2008 revised. There's a reasonable inference that can be drawn from this that their actions were intentional. And if you look forward, King and Hutt were the only sales representatives to receive warning status, of course, in the Indianapolis region. There's a fiction that's created by Solvay at this point in time that Julia Hutt's responsibilities were anything but selling. Julia was denied. Solvay Abbott ignored her talent, and the evidence is clear that she was one of the most successful Androgel salespersons in the country and was experiencing continuous improvement. Lozen failed to provide instructions on the policy. We're going to move on to retaliation. The district judge did not consider the circumstances that were the basis of Mrs. Hutt's filing the EEOC charges. And she's entitled to that at trial. What were the facts and circumstances that led up to the February 9th, 2009 filing of the EEOC claim? There was a meeting in May of 2009 where Westfall, who is the identified management person in the EEOC charges, says to Mrs. Hutt, I want you and your lawyer to go to Atlanta and to explain your EEOC charges. Exhibit 7 to Hutt's affidavit shows the retaliation for age discrimination. The relevant time for knowledge is when the alleged retaliation took place. Westfall and Lozen failed to lift the warnings, even though Hutt in 2009 was rated 27 out of 72, and King, on the date of his termination, 14 out of 74. The district court found that this lady, Mrs. Hutt, was physically grabbed by Lozen on a number of occasions in 2009. The district judge pointed to Netterville, who was partnered with her in 2010, who got preferential treatment, and that involved Lozen sending an email to to Netterville but not to King about prospective doctors to call on. In 2010, Julie Hutt was rated 7th in the region. Netterville was rated 8th, yet Netterville received the awards and plaque, and Julie Hutt did not. A negative job action. In 2011, Abbott started giving Hutt and Netterville the same rank number. This was not, no other sales representative in the region were provided the same ranked number as their counterpart.
So do you want to reserve any time for rebuttal?
Yes, I do.
Klinghoffer.
Thank you. May it please the Court, John Klinghoffer on behalf of Appalese. I'm here with my colleague, Kristen Jones. There's a few points that I'd like to clarify based on Mr. Foley's presentation. He indicated that Mr. Westfall brought Ms. Hutt in May of 2009 and told her that they need to go down to Atlanta and she needs to disclaim her EEOC charge. That's not what the record indicates with respect to that conversation. With respect to that conversation, the conversation was that Mr. Westfall apparently in an angry tone indicated that I'd like you to come down to Atlanta to discuss your EEOC charge with your attorney. There certainly wasn't any reference in any of the record that he asked her to disclaim the EEOC charge. With respect to Mr. Foley's position that all that mattered for pharmaceutical sales reps is their sales numbers, the undisputed evidence shows otherwise. The undisputed evidence shows that both Solvay and Abbott weighed the employees' core competencies, which include administrative responsibilities, knowledge, strategic planning, and execution and leadership, more heavily than they weighed the employees' sales numbers. Why is this so? Because unlike a typical salesperson who's selling, say, vacuum cleaners, the sales representatives' interactions with healthcare professionals are very regulated. So they're regulated with respect to what they can say to the sales rep, to the healthcare professional. They're regulated with respect to records of samples delivered, money spent during the interaction. They're all regulated. And not only does the sales representative have to comply with those regulations, they have to create documents that can prove that they complied with the regulations. The import of these core competencies is clearly evidenced in the weighing of an employee's performance evaluation. In 2007 and 2008, it's undisputed that an employee's annual performance evaluation was weighted 60% for core competencies, 40% for sales numbers. In 2009 and 10, it's undisputed that a sales representative's performance evaluation was weighted 80% core competencies and only 20% for sales numbers. Neither Hutt nor King were disciplined or put on a performance warning because of their sales numbers. It was issues with their core competencies. And these issues, they weren't new for Ms. Hutt. There was not a change in the way Ms. Hutt had been treated. Ms. Hutt, during her time with her previous supervisors, had similar issues addressing her administrative duties, so much so that her 2005 evaluation indicates she was put on an informal PIP for failing to timely complete her administrative duties. There's no evidence that anybody who had similar core competency deficiencies as Ms. Hutt wasn't disciplined. With respect to the question on whether or not the informal warning in any way affected Ms. Hutt's ability to get a bonus, the answer is clearly no.
Well, doesn't the district judge find that the informal warnings, or the formal ones, are just a continuation of the informal ones?
That's what he finds. And in appellant's reply brief, they indicate that the informal warning was some type of condition precedent prior to entering into a formal warning. There's no record support for that at all. There's nothing in the record that indicates that the informal warning was a necessary predicate.
So the judge was wrong when he found
that particular fact. On that particular fact, I think he was. There's nothing to support the fact that it was. It happened to be in Ms. Hutt's case that that was the steps that occurred.
And so he also found that reasons Lowe's and Westfall gave were fishy, suspicious.
Yeah, he did. He did make that conclusion. With respect to the informal warning, and I think if you take a closer look at the actions with respect to that informal warning, I think you'll find that there's a reason for the informal warning. As I discussed before, Ms. Hutt had prior issues with administrative...
Well, the district judge says there's a question of fact about all that.
Whether or not there was it was fishy, he determined, yes, that he thought it was fishy. That particular issue, it didn't affect A or wage payment claim, and he certainly didn't make any ruling with respect to the placement on the formal warning that it was fishy. In fact, between the time of the informal warning and the formal warning, here's what happened. Ms. Hutt didn't complete the administrative responsibilities that she was supposed to. She's the only one who needed training. No one else in the district, the record shows that no one else in the district needed the training that she sought. No one else in the district was having similar administrative problems. The training was provided to her on the 26th. However,
isn't that the same day she's placed on warning?
It is the same day she was placed on warning. But in the
mind, she doesn't get the training until she's on warning?
Well, no one else needed the training. And she was provided the training. She still didn't get it done a month later. Everybody else had it done without the training prior. She also points to the fact that the March 7th PharmaSource, which is one of the administrative softwares, wasn't available to everybody on March 7th. And she said, I didn't even have this available until March 7th. Yet the same email that's in the record that shows that this March 7th PharmaSource was available to everybody also indicates that everybody needed to get it done in 2 days over the weekend. Everybody else did. Ms. Hutt didn't. So she was provided the training with her informal warning and still didn't get the responsibilities done that she needed to. Also, during the time frame between the informal warning and her formal warning, Mr. Lozen's receiving emails from a third party. At this time, Solvay and Abbott were two separate companies. They were co-promoting a drug. So the sales reps from Abbott were calling on the same doctors with the same product as Ms. Hutt was. And Mr. Lozen receives emails from a district manager at Abbott indicating that Ms. Hutt was interfering with the Abbott sales representative's performance of their duties, scheduling lunches without notifying them, canceling visits, and the like. This is all going into the mind of Brian Lozen that places him or that allows him to place her on a formal warning. That's why the formal warning is legitimate. There were reasons that it happened. With respect to her age discrimination claim, I mean, the court was absolutely correct. There simply isn't any evidence here, even if it was pretext. There's no evidence tying it to age. The only issues involving age in this whole case are Brian Lozen's request for birth dates in January of 2008, which this court has held, similar requests and similar knowledge of age isn't enough to be direct evidence as plaintiff appellant asserts in their reply, nor is it sufficient by itself to constitute circumstantial evidence of age discrimination without more. Well, what's the more in this case? The only more in this case is the fact that Ms. Hutt and Mr. King were placed on warning. There's no evidence in the record that Mr. King was placed on warning for an untrue reason. He was placed on a formal warning for inadequate utilization of regional marketing funds, receiving a developmental needs at a basic training course, increasing the number of sales calls where he delivers samples, increasing his daily sales calls, period. He needed to call on more doctors. There's no evidence that any of that was untrue. So you have two underperforming people that happen to be old. That's all they have here. None of the other adverse actions get tied anyway to age discrimination. And quite honestly, they didn't meet their burden of creating an inference that any of the adverse actions were the result or the but-for cause of the litany of the purported adverse actions that she suffered. Her retaliation claim suffers the same issues. There's the only protected activity that she engaged in was the filing of an EEOC charge on February 9th. Ms. Hutt's failed to provide any record of any evidence tying any adverse action to the filing of that February 9th EEOC charge, let alone evidence showing that the filing of her February 9th EEOC charge was the but-for cause of an adverse action. There's no record evidence of any similarly situated individual who did not engage in protected conduct treated better than Ms. Hutt. The record shows that all of the post-February 9th, 2009 adverse actions occurred between 14 months and 3 years after the filing of her EEOC charge. There's simply nothing tying any of the adverse actions to the filing of her EEOC charge, and for that reason, her retaliation claim fails as well. With respect to the Indiana Wage Payment Act claim, the court did nothing but comply with Indiana law in its analysis of her claim. The wages she contends she's owed are the bonuses that she was denied as a result of being placed on formal or final warning. She's only owed wages under the Act if she earned them, and the court correctly held that she didn't earn them. And had it do that, it applied Indiana law. The leading case in Indiana with respect to whether a bonus earned is a 1942 case, Montgomery Ward versus Guyonnet. There, a former employee alleged that he was wrongfully terminated and denied a bonus, and the company refused to pay him his bonus for the year. My time is up.
Pierce.
You can make the concluding thought.
The concluding thought is all that the judge did was comply with Indiana law and find that they had a legitimate reason to place her on warning. The plain language of the plan is that if you're on warning, you don't get a bonus. She didn't get a bonus because of that.
Thank you, Mr. Klinghoffer. Mr. Foley.
Thank you, Your Honor. There is nothing in this record that shows, as stated by Mr. Klinghoffer, that nobody else needed training. There's nothing in the record that shows that. All of the statements made by Abbott Solvay have been denied by my client. There are material issues of fact here. There's hair splitting when you say, well, the informal warning is so different. It isn't. It has the same legs that the formal warning has. And they didn't change the evaluation. So the informal evaluation that they, on the 26th of March, became the same evaluation. The status of my client as an over 40 is protected.
Thank you, Mr. Foley. Thank you, Mr. Klinghoffer. Ms. Jones, case is taken under